This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Is psychiatry in crisis? Harvard psychiatrist Alan Hobson and medical journalist Jonathan Leonard say the answer to that question is beyond a doubt, yes. Here's how they put it in their book, Out of Its Mind, Psychiatry in Crisis, A Call for Reform. Anyone seeking mental health care today runs a high risk of getting low-grade treatment. Beyond that, millions of people with severe mental ills are being improperly treated or neglected. Coordination and follow-up efforts on their behalf range from poor to nil, and degeneration within the field has reached a point where we now have a choice of actively rebuilding psychiatry or else being prepared to see it fall apart. Hobson and Leonard say psychiatry suffers from a lack of public confidence. They also say the people who do the counseling and the people who prescribe the pills aren't talking to one another. Their book, Out of Its Mind, offers readers an outline of what's wrong with psychiatry, how it got that way, and what's needed to fix it. Dr. Alan Hobson and Jonathan Leonard are our guests in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. And listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Alan Hobson is a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and director of the Laboratory of Neurophysiology at the Massachusetts Mental Health Center. He is the author of several books, including The Dreaming Brain and Sleep. Jonathan Leonard is a freelance medical writer and contributing editor at Harvard Magazine. Dr. Hobson, Mr. Leonard, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you.
The two of you would like to see a coming together of brain and mind in psychiatry. You'd like to see psychiatry take an approach that combines what is known about the brain with what we've been doing for a long time now with therapy. It's something that you call neurodynamics. To begin with, Dr. Hobson, how different is neurodynamics from the status quo?
Well, it's very different. It's different in the way that Sigmund Freud would have liked it to be. He wanted to base his dynamic psychology upon brain science, but not enough was known at the time that he formulated psychoanalytic theory to do that. And surely today we still would find the job daunting, but there are lots of ways in which we can begin to build a neurodynamic psychiatry. And there's no place where the example is clearer than in the theory of dreams, which was, of course, the keystone of Freud's arch. The whole edifice of his theory collapses without the dream theory. And the dream theory was built without any knowledge of the physiology of sleep. So I think we could, if we begin there, we can see very clearly how this thing is going to be different. It's not going to say that dreams have no meaning. It's not going to say that dreams aren't of interest to psychiatrists working with patients. Certainly not going to say that dreams aren't of any interest to theory builders. It's going to say that anything you say about dreams now has to take account of the burgeoning information about the brain, and it's extraordinary in this area, and it has been actually in this area since 1975, so we've had a quarter century already to rebuild the dream theory. The question is now, can we move to other areas like, for instance, the first place where Freud started, dissociative phenomena? And we think there, too, that a lot has been learned about the brain that helps us understand how dissociative phenomena occur. One of them, of course, is dreaming itself. In dreaming, we think we're awake, but we're not. And we know the reasons now for that in terms of the brain regions that are active and inactive during the sorts of sleep in which dreaming is most impressive. So dissociation will probably be next. Hypnosis, we think, may lend itself to analysis via neurodynamics. And of course, already there's evidence that schizophrenia and major affective disorders have brain bases. What they are, dynamically speaking, remains to be seen, but depression is obviously one in which we've already made a lot of progress, and it's related to the dream, sleep dream story. So if that's not too vague a promise, I'd be happy to go into more specifics about how these principles actually work.
Hmm. Before we do that, I wanted to bring Jonathan Leonard in.
Please.
to the conversation. From where you sit as a medical journalist, what do you find in this field that excites you? Offer us an example of something that you've learned about neuroscientists and the work that they're doing, and its potential impact in psychiatry.
Well, there's been enormous progress in brain science over the in neuroscience over the last 50 years, but it's accelerated over the last three decades, and especially since MRI imaging has come in as a complementary tool to the older techniques that neuroscientists had been using to get in and study the brain. I got into this general subject of psychiatry and possible psychiatric reform, and found that the potential contribution of brain science to this area is enormous. It's not just a small thing, and it's bigger than I thought when I started, because there is the biggest problem in psychiatry today is that there's a tremendous, not only is there a public lack of confidence in it, but there's a lack of a full bore and effective coordination between the use of drugs to treat severe mental illnesses, and in fact other mental illnesses as well, and proper kinds of therapy, because generally the therapists don't have a medical background. The psychiatrists don't have much time to make contact with their patients. Coordination between the two different groups is poor, and the whole arrangement could be immensely better coordinated if everybody involved had some kind of effective brain science foundation. Mm-hmm. And they don't, so there's room for an enormous contribution here.
Yeah. I know of someone who is dealing with major depression, and his time with a psychiatrist, an appointment, 10-15 minutes. The appointment is for the purpose of managing medications. And the counseling he receives is through a social worker.
Yeah.
Now, both of these people are not easy to see. You have to wait to see them. Their schedules are extremely tight. How typical is this situation?
Why don't you respond, Jonathan, from a broad perspective, and I'll answer the question from the perspective of a practicing psychiatrist.
Well, from what I could gather from the interviews we conducted in association with the book, it's fairly typical. Now, the times you mentioned are a little shorter than times that I got. I picked up times typically of 15 minutes to 20 minutes for an appointment for diagnosing the illness, maintaining contact with the patient, and managing the drug prescription. Another point about this is that the times between appointments can often be quite long, say 3 months.
Hmm.
I think it's typical, and I think it's woeful. I think it's very unfortunate. The split is wrong. The same person should be doing both. And I've practiced psychiatry for 30 years, and I must say that 15-minute visits are just inadequate. Certainly, especially if they're once every 3 months. A lot of what we're trying to do in our call for reform is to reinstitute the value of psychologically sensitive treatment. We're not trying to resuscitate psychoanalysis as such, but we do think the analysts were right in emphasizing, one, feelings, and two, the exploration of feelings in a protected, comfortable setting. This is crucial to people, whether you think that disorders of feelings are causal of their illnesses or not, they have them. And they're working at a tremendous competitive disadvantage in life. They need support. They need the opportunity to explore. And they need to feel above all that there's someone there for them, that there's an ally who understands the psychological impact as well as the psychological progenitors of the illness. And I just can't imagine doing that and prescribing, and I do prescribe, I do both, in less than 40 minutes, frankly. And I just don't think there's a third party out there who will pay you for that beyond perhaps 10 visits or that, something like that. Unfortunately, people don't get well in 10 visits, especially if they have major mental illness. So I think it's typical, I think it's willful, and I think we need to do something about it.
Yeah. I want to also talk here about the situation in hospitals. People who are admitted are likely to be in the hospital for just a couple of days these days.
Yeah, right.
The immediate crisis is met. Then, as you say in the book, they're up and out. But this interests me, too, because the medications they're given may take some time to become effective.
Several weeks, quite often.
Yeah. So, you know, how is it that we're able to say these folks are stable, you're okay, we'll see you later?
Well, we are not able to say that, and I mean, we don't say that. We feel that that this again is a very complicated issue. It's not just that hospital stays have been abbreviated; it's that hospitals have been abbreviated. Mental hospitals, as we point out in the book, were essentially eliminated as an institution with the advent of the medication. So you have this curious paradox now of psychiatry having traded away its institutional base. That's bad for those of us who practice. It's worse for patients. There's no place to go. General hospitals are not ideal settings for dealing with major mental illness. In fact, general hospitals don't want people around who are psychotic. And the third parties won't pay to keep them there. So again, I mean, in complementing what I said earlier about office visits and how they should be structured and who should do them and what should be said, we feel very strong, make a strong plea for the reinstitution of mental health centers worthy of the name. There was, in addition to the emptying of the mental hospitals in the early 60s, there was an attempt to set up neighborhood clinics. These, in our view, haven't really worked very well, and they need improvement.
The situation today isn't good, but, you know, looking back to the hospitals of the past, they weren't so good either.
They were terrible, but
yeah.
Realize that the big change in, you know, the good news is the mental hospitals are no longer as much needed and therefore can't be abused. The bad news is that they hardly exist, and so you have no choice, especially where the illness is so severe that it's likely to require medication trials that need to be observed, with side effects also in addition to the you know, sometimes 3 to 5 weeks before you know anything's really going to work or not. So what we're advocating is a much more specific a program, probably would have to be a national program, we think, that would have neighborhood mental health centers in important parts of states. States would pay for part of it, and the federal government would pay for part of it, and what that would offer would be the option of inpatient hospitalization. I mean, I have many of my patients asking to be hospitalized, knowing they can't function in the outside world and being unable to find them any decent place to go. So we're not advocating any more than we're advocating a return to, you know, long-bearded psychoanalysis, a return to snake pit state hospitals, far from it. But at Mass Mental Health Center, where I work, it's very hard to get support either from the state or for the federal government to do the sort of rebuilding that needs to be done. And we, in the book, we use Mass Mental Health Center as our case example. I mean, here we are in the center of academic psychiatry in Boston, a walking distance from the labs where the cutting-edge work is being done in brain science. And I mean, it's really a shame to look at that building and see how it's been allowed to deteriorate and how the practice of psychiatry has changed such that you can't admit a patient to Mass Mental Health Center even if you want to.
Hmm. What kind of reaction is the book getting from people in the field?
Well, everyone that we've talked to, you know, and we talk to our friends, of course, so we have to be reserved about this. They all say yes. I mean, why wasn't this book written, 20 years ago? And we might ask ourselves the same question. The answer is that, as Jonathan points out, the dynamic part of neurodynamics in humans comes from the imaging. And I'd like to say a couple more words about that, because mm-hmm. I'm sure most people know that PET images can be made of the brain, but do they know that we can now do MRI, magnetic resonance imagery, and get, real-time movies of the brain functioning? That's what's changed, and one of our calls is for these centers all should have MRI or PET capability, because we can now study the human brain in action without making a hole, without injecting a drug, and the progress in sleep and dream science is just, it's like a millennial. And so we think that other functional states will also benefit from this sort of approach. Imaging is just an amazing, it's not just pictures, it's pictures that reflect the functional activity, the parts of the brain. And we've never been able to do this before. So that's the reason for why now, I think, more than anything else.
Mm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us this afternoon on Line 1 in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi. I think I have a couple of things. I think you're starting to get at it, which is you were all talking in terms of the people that can go for hospitalization, but there's the vast majority of people don't have coverage. Even better plans don't have health coverage. And if they're talking about a patient's bill of rights in Washington, maybe they ought to include that as well. But so that's maybe not quite germane.
It is germane. Let me just address that right up front. I mean, we think that the abandonment of the public patient is, my son has just walked in and he's greeting me, and I'm responding because I don't want him to be a middle patient. Yes, of course, we need more public funding for the severely mentally ill. Especially those who have no insurance. I mean, mental illness is uninsurable, let's face it. It can't be insured by any actuarial private company. It lasts too long, it's too disabling. The public sector, breathed a great sigh of relief when Thorazine came along. They closed the hospitals, everyone out on the streets. But now they've filtered back. They sleep on the steam grates, they're in jails. Many of them are in jails. Jonathan makes that point very clearly in the book. So for sure, you're absolutely right. We need more funding for the patient, for the uninsurables and the uninsured.
I wanted to ask you about Peter Bragan and the other people that are making critiques of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And I don't know, he's at least convinced me that the studies haven't been done to show that it's really that we know what consequences are over the long term, because longitudinal studies just haven't been done about the suppression of the what are they called, the places in the synapse, the
sure.
interlocking
my colleagues think I'm an alarmist about the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And perhaps I am, but the Thorazine story tells us that the longer you have this medication aboard, the more likely you are to develop peculiar nervous system side effects. In the case of Thorazine, it was tardive dyskinesia, Parkinson-like syndrome that developed sometimes only after 15 or 20 years, by the way. The SSRIs are already beginning to show their their problematic side in, surprisingly enough, the field of sleep and dreams. People who develop what we call REM sleep behavior disorder, that is the acting out of dreams, not sleepwalking. Sleepwalking occurs in non-REM sleep when dreaming is not present or not as abundantly present as it is in REM. They act out their dreams because they can't inhibit the musculature that is normally inhibited that prevents us from acting out our dreams. These SSRIs have a way of somehow spoiling that mechanism. And in fact, a lot of the people who have REM sleep behavior disorder after prolonged SSRI treatment also go on to develop Parkinsonism. So we're going to see that there's no free lunch here in the pharmacology arena either. I mean, we're not at all happy with the idea that psychiatry can be medicalized in the sense of, you know, treating pneumonia with penicillin. We're nowhere near the magic bullet idiom in psychiatry, and that's another reason for cautious, expert, close scrutiny of what happens when patients take the pills, if they take the pills. Of course, compliance is a big issue too, but I think Breggin is, if anything, probably underestimating the problems that will arise. Look, the good news is that these drugs affect the state control systems of the brain. State being, am I awake, am I asleep, am I dreaming, am I perceiving normally, or am I hallucinating and deluding? Those are all state-dependent functions, and they're controlled by a relatively small and discrete number of chemically specific neuronal systems. And the drug companies, God bless them, have produced these drugs that affect them. But the bad news is the same as the good news. I mean, state control is a global phenomenon. It affects all aspects of brain function and behavior. And if you control these systems artificially, you're going to drive them into states that are unexpected. And I think side effects are you know, the order.
Could I ask you about that first syndrome you outlined? Does this mean that people are conscious and they're doing something and they just don't know why they're doing it? Don't
know
why they
can't stop?
No, they're
likely to wake up from sleep. Their spouse is likely to say to you, look, he was asleep, and then the next thing I knew, he was running around the bedroom acting like he was playing football. He is, in fact, acting out his dreams. So, no, it is not a wake state phenomenon. There are SSRI problems in waking, but I just used that as an example because it's not common. I mean, everyone taking SSRIs that's listening to this program should not immediately stop, but they should be aware that long-term use can produce this very dramatic and very unwelcome side effect, and it is related to Parkinsonism. So what I was, I think, circling around to say is that among the systems that are controlled by state control neuromodulators are the motor system. I mean, the motor system is one of the key examples. In order to go to sleep, you have to turn it off. In order to dream, you have to turn it off actively and keep it off, even though motor programs are being run in the brain. So there's a lot of precise, if you'll pardon the expression, neurodynamic work being done by these systems, and the drugs interact with them in ways that are in part desirable and, no surprise, in part undesirable.
Could I ask you to elaborate on what you mean by state control? And then the other thing is, if the longitudinal studies were never done by Lilly to show whether these locuses regenerate on the synapses, are the new imaging techniques being used to sort of get in that close and look at
two important
synaptic
questions? Let me,
thanks,
let me
I'll
answer
hang up
the
and listen.
Second one first. And yes, the imaging is being used to look at receptors, which is probably the word you're hunting for. And drugs that are tagged and label receptors are now being used to extend the imaging technology into the domain of psychopharmacology. It's very new. It's very experimental. And as yet, we don't have dramatic fruit from that source. But state control is an important concept. It's one that we make throughout the book and others of my writings. The easiest way is to give you an example. I mean, you're in the wake state now. You're talking to me on the phone. You're processing what I say in a relatively linear, logical way. You're able to keep intrusive thoughts and feelings out of your mind in order to understand what I'm saying. Well, after you've been asleep for a couple of hours and your brain changes state, it not only goes to sleep, but it reactivates. It starts to make you dream. You won't be able to do any of these things that you can do now. You might have a dream about this conversation or some aspect of the conversation, but you won't be able to pay attention. You won't be able to critically evaluate what you're thinking and feeling. And that, of course, is exactly the situation that the so-called mentally ill suffer from. They have it in waking, unfortunately. We relatively healthy individuals only have such bizarre states when we're asleep, and that's the good news, but you see what I mean.
Mm. Back to the idea of using MRI imaging to study how the drugs work, how are those studies being carried out?
Well, basically, you need to label the receptors in some way such that their activity is altered and can be detected. If you use a radio label, that's one way. We'd prefer not to do that because then we have to introduce radioactive material, and that's true of all the PET studies, by the way. I mean, PET studies still are limiting because of this problem. So far, MRI pharmacology doesn't exist, but someone will figure out how to label chemically specific neurons such that they can be seen in the MRI. I mean, we didn't know how to do any of this when histology first began. And so what the reason why I'm emphasizing MRI is not because of its immediate applicability to psychopharmacology, but because it enables us, instead of taking snapshots, which we do with PET, to have continuous imaging resolution. Another way to look at this would be to say we could use MRI to study the effectiveness of a drug. We could see if, for example, the characteristic depressive pattern of, you know, frontal lobe deactivation was reversed by a SSRI, just to use one example. Then we'd have more reason to think that drug was worth keeping on board despite the risks. That's one of a number of examples that one could easily think of, MRI to the rescue.
Interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guests this afternoon are Harvard psychiatrist Alan Hobson and medical journalist Jonathan Leonard. They are the authors of the new book, Out of Its Mind, Psychiatry in Crisis, A Call for Reform. Listeners, questions and comments are welcome. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We go now to the toll-free line, a listener in Terre Haute. Hello.
Hello. My question is, I wonder if the latest research with MRIs and any other method has found a link between epileptic seizures and migraine headaches.
I have to plead ignorance, but no doubt that is one of the that's a neurodynamic phenomena that has been typically handled by neurologists, and I'm not copping out on that score. I think psychiatrists also are interested in epilepsy and in migraine. They're both functional disorders of the brain, and certainly imaging has been used to study epilepsy. I can answer that. If not MRI, then both SPECT and PET have been used. In fact, we have been doing studies ourselves looking at seizure foci that are inactive and undetectable by other means and seeing whether they become activated in sleep. This is related to the previous caller's question about state control. Epilepsy is state-dependent. Migraine is state-dependent. I had cluster headaches. They were markedly state-dependent. Every time I went to sleep, these things were much more likely to occur. Now, as a generalization, we can see why. The excitability of specific brain regions changes as a function of state. So if, for example, you have an epileptic focus in your temporal lobe, you're very likely to heat that focus up during REM sleep because the temporal lobe is selectively activated. That's also interesting because dreams are very much like the fugue states that temporal lobe epileptics suffer. So we're actually thinking in our kind of casting our neurodynamic net wide that we can begin to make a common ground between epilepsy, dreaming, and psychosis. Migraine, I don't know so much about. My wife, who's a neurologist, could answer that question very well. Jonathan, can you say anything?
I have no information that
but
I've come across.
You know, it's a dynamic condition of the brain. Most people think related to vasculature. What is happening when you take a PET snapshot or an MRI image is that you're looking at blood flow, really. And you're inferring increases in local neuronal activity correlated with increased blood flow. The neurons fire more; they ask for more oxygen. The circulatory system delivers it, and or the neuromodulators that control a state anyway activate one part of the brain and activate the blood flow to that part of the brain, so that it will be able to function in an exaggerated or heightened way. And so, of course, migraine will show itself if it hasn't already done so.
Can blood sugar be a factor in triggering migraines?
Again, that's a question that's sort of off limits for me. But,
sure.
Let me answer the question indirectly. Amazingly, recently, Ev Van Cauter, a colleague of ours in Chicago, has shown that sleep deprivation drives people in the direction of diabetes. That doesn't mean that sleep deprivation causes diabetes. It means that it shifts metabolism in that direction. So that would mean that sleep is protective against diabetes. If you have certainly low blood sugar, you're very likely to increase seizure propensity. In fact, insulin shock treatment, which was one of the most outlandish and shameful organic treatments that were used in the 1930s and 40s, precipitated seizures by lowering blood sugar. So yes, the answer is certainly generically yes. The brain is exquisitely sensitive to oxygen, oxygen lack, glucose, and glucose lack.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks for
the
call.
Thanks for calling.
Next, we're going to talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I've been sitting here thinking about the topics that are appropriate for this call. For this show. And I guess I've got, I could come up with two questions, which would kind of be in the realm that you're talking about. One would be, I'm curious if anybody's looked at or looked in the direction of trying to prove or somehow establish the mind's a mind being present or a consciousness being present in other animals besides man, for number one. I think I'll just wait and see if there's an answer to that.
Let's take that
well,
one, because then we have... Johnny, you want to do it?
Sure.
Do it.
The first thing you have to really do is define consciousness. If you define, consciousness as awareness of information that is processed by the brain, then probably, you'd find that mice and everything on up is conscious to some degree, but of course the degree of consciousness depends on the degree of sophistication of the brain. And so the level of consciousness is I think, what's important if you take this definition, and you don't have to because there are lots of others, But if you take the definition that consciousness is awareness of information processed by the brain, then the consciousness of a chimpanzee or something like that is a great deal less than ours, and you have to realize that most of what we think of as consciousness, at least as far as conscious thought is concerned, which is what people like to concentrate on in many cases, then that kind of thing is rather difficult if you don't have language. And if you don't have a spoken language, you're very unlikely to have an interior language that can handle that kind of thought. And so the degree of consciousness diminishes sharply when you subtract language.
I guess in part I was thinking about the news recently about the dolphins being able to recognize themselves in mirrors, and how chimpanzees also can, I believe. And I was just curious if that can be shown through, if there's some sort of segment of the brain that is particularly active for that kind of recognition. I guess that was kind of what I was thinking of.
You're asking good questions. I mean, certainly, I would say this, Jonathan, that this question used to be considered, beyond the pale of science. Even to talk about consciousness at all was for 30 or 40 years a forbidden taboo. I think now you're going to see a lot more of this sort of modeling and empirical proof or empirical investigation of the degree to which subhuman animals are conscious will certainly take advantage of imaging tools as well as others. I mean, all the mammals have the cardinal states that we humans enjoy. So, a corollary question is, do animals dream? Well, and if so, what do they dream of? Nobody doubts, I think, that cats have perceptions. They recognize things. Why is it hard to imagine them having those recognitions offline if their associative visual brains are activated? That's not proof, of course. That just means that I think now we see ways in which that's not only possible but quite likely. And we see ways in which we could shore up the assumed likelihood with empirical data.
And my other question had to do with what you mentioned, using insulin for shock, I believe it was, or
insulin shock treatment, it was
right,
called.
Yeah.
And they put people in insulin coma, basically.
Yeah, I was always curious as to, I was always surprised that electroshock treatment would work. It just seems such an unlikely thing. I mean, we've got computers where if they get any kind of a surge of electricity, they just get totally, knocked to the floor. But the human brain apparently can withstand electroshock and then come out of it at the other end and still, be reasonably, work properly. And I was just curious if rather than going the extreme that they did,
sure,
if that whole area has ever been explored.
Oh yes,
in
and
way.
Electric shock is still used, and it's still appropriately used. I share your horror about it, but I've had patients who insist upon it. They say, "Yeah, I know that amitriptyline will help my depression, but shock will make me feel better in 3 days. So buzz me." I mean, it's incredible. It's very effective. Now the question is why? We don't really know, but of course the brain is not a computer. It's a different kind of, it is a computer, but a different kind of computer. And one of the systems that seems to be most deranged in mental illness are these modulatory systems, especially those that control sleep and dreams, and especially in depression. And, one can easily imagine turning those systems on with electricity. If, again, this is a hypothesis. Nobody's proved that, depression, that the favorable effects of electric shock treatment on depression are due to the activation of modulatory systems. But it would be a leading hypothesis if I were going to, you know, fund a group of grants, I'd be looking for proposals along those lines. So, you know, the other answer to your question is that transcranial magnetic stimulation is now being shown to be effective. In other words, by holding a magnetic device over the brain, one can depolarize enough neurons to have palpable effects on movement, on mood, on the capacity to understand and perceive. So the brain is an electrical organ, among other things. It has electrical properties that are very different from those of artificial circuitry, but it responds to external currents and it responds to external magnetic fields in a dramatic and interesting way. Again, the new neurodynamics will take all of that into account.
I'd like to say a little bit about the social side of the electroshocks business.
Sure.
It is intuitively we are raised to fear the idea of passing an electric current through the human body. One just doesn't do such things, and one knows it can have terrible consequences. But so far as electroshock is concerned, if it's done in a controlled manner and in a reasonably small number of instances, there is very little evidence that it does any significant harm at all. The problem is that in the, 60s, 70s, the public became concerned about it because of the obvious alarm that any normal person would have about such a procedure. And so it was essentially, it became extremely unfashionable, and that's an understatement. And it has still not worked its way back into, let's say, fashionability. It still hasn't worked its way out of the darkness, even though it appears to be, for certain illnesses such as depression, a very useful tool. And so it's probably still underused.
I want to thank the listener for his questions this afternoon. We just have just a little bit more time to spend together today. And before we go, I want to ask you this question. You propose strengthening psychiatry's base in brain science and some other reforms in your book. Reform takes time, though, and there are a lot of folks out there suffering. What can we do now? What can we start working on to alleviate the worst ills of psychiatry? The folks who are homeless, the folks who are in jails and prisons, and those who are out on probation, for that matter.
You want to take that first, Jonathan?
Certainly. You can. The first and easiest step, I think, is to start working on better coordination. Doing enough of your coordinating between the psychopharmacologist and the therapist and the social services and the people who work in homeless centers and the people who work in prisons to see that people who are not lost to treatment, the treatment has some kind of continuity, and to see that that kind of continuity is strengthened. And that if a person is lost to treatment, somebody goes out and finds out what's going on.
My answer is probably not going to satisfy you, because you want to know, you know, what you can do tomorrow, not just, you know, 3 years from now. But we make a strong case in our book for education, and I think that we probably don't go far enough with it. We're talking about educating college students, high school students, people, younger people who need to know that this is a field of great opportunity. But we'd like to educate the public as well, and we think our book is not bad at that. It certainly covers the major mental illnesses in the central part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about all of the sorts of problems that people have and make specific suggestions. Don't be satisfied with treatment you don't feel is adequate. I think shopping and moving and even a kind of client entrepreneurism is really necessary here. I find patients who find me sympathetic. You know, but you know, again, if you go to a clinic and you get the cold shoulder, you're told you have to wait 4 weeks for an appointment. Just don't do it. Get on the phone and call some other people. Don't be satisfied. Obviously, I could go on and say, write your congressman and all that sort of stuff, but I think activism, informed activism, is an important stance for patients and their families to take. The squeaky wheel gets the oil, and it always has and it always will. There are people out there who know what we're saying, and you can find them.
Thank you very much for visiting with us this afternoon, talking with us. Harvard psychiatrist Alan Hobson has been our guest this afternoon, along with medical journalist Jonathan Leonard. They are the authors of Out of Its Mind, Psychiatry in Crisis, A Call for Reform. The book offers readers an outline of what's wrong with psychiatry, how it got that way, and what they'd like to see, what they think is needed to fix it. Out of Its Mind, Psychiatry in Crisis, A Call for Reform.